General Motors has a new CEO today. Dan Akerson is GM's fourth CEO since last year. It's a sign of all the change and instability at the car maker, which is still the largest in the U.S. market. But the former phone executive and financier is still a mystery man to many in Detroit.
As far as people who follow the auto industry can tell, he's not really a car guy, and we're not 100% sure what he's bringing to the table here.
Auto reporter Micheline Maynard is senior editor at Chicago Public Radio's Project Changing Gears.
He certainly proved himself in the IT and the high-tech market. He led very well at Nextel and other places, but that was a while ago. He sort of disappeared into the private capital market, and now I think everyone is wondering, you know, who is Dan Akerson and what will he do with General Motors?
Akerson takes over at a critical moment for the car maker. It's about to launch a public stock offering. It's rolling out key new models, and the company must fend off Ford, which is breathing down GM's neck for the number one spot in U.S. car sales.
This is All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. A new study says that young, childless women now make more on average than their male counterparts. It's based on data gathered by the Census Bureau and analyzed by a private research firm. As NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports, it's part of a long trend that mirrors a trend in education.
If you now look at most areas of the country, unmarried women without kids from age 22 to 30 are making 8% more than men in the same demographic. And there is one major reason for that.
At this point in time, young women are 1.5 times more likely to earn college degrees than their male counterparts. That's a huge difference. And it's starting to reflect in average income.
That is James Chung, president of Reach Advisors, which did the study. Chung says it is still the case that overall women make 80% of what men make. And the survey is not saying that a woman in the same job makes more than a man. It's still not certain whether these findings signal a significant change. The big question is whether, as this group of women ages, marries, or has children, their wage advantage will disappear. Chung says he hasn't seen any evidence that it will go away. He points out that male-dominated industries like manufacturing were hit harder this recession. There are more women in managerial jobs now than men. And Chung says it's likely that when the economy rebounds, this new generation of women will be better poised to make more money.
We're seeing a preview of the post-recession economy. Who's going to be out there earning the higher incomes, and who's going to be out there reshaping the markets?
So, you're a man. How does this make you feel?
I live in one of those households.
For the up-and-coming generation, it is simply the new norm, he says. Jacqueline King is a policy analyst for the American Council on Education. She agrees education is the most important factor in explaining why younger women are making more than younger men. But she's not ready to say that these results mark a watershed event for women's wages overall.
If you were to compare women and men with similar levels of education, you would find that the men do still continue to earn more, in part because they are more likely to choose higher paying fields.
For nearly two decades, women have outnumbered men going to college. This is particularly pronounced among minority groups and at historically black colleges where women outnumber men 2-to-1. Some colleges are now trying to attract more male students by starting men's groups, showcasing their sports, and offering subjects that tend to draw in men. But King says the fact remains that even though women are going to college in greater numbers, they are more likely to take jobs in lower-paying fields like education, while men are more likely to end up in relatively high-paying positions in business and technology.
Also, women are much more likely to take time away from their careers for childcare and other family responsibilities, and that has an impact on their earnings over the course of their careers.
Chung of Reach Advisors says he plans to track these young women over the next few years to see whether, in fact, they do manage to close the gender gap. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
The former head of the bankrupt investment bank Lehman Brothers was on Capitol Hill yesterday testifying before officials investigating the causes of the financial crisis. Richard Fuld blamed his company's downfall on regulators, not bad investments. NPR's Brett Neely reports.
Fold said his firm was as sound as other banks were in the fall of 2008. The only difference, he said, were unfounded rumors that Lehman was in trouble.
This loss of confidence in Lehman, although unjustified and irrational, became a self-fulfilling prophecy.
When asked if Lehman had taken on too many risky trading positions, Fold said no.
Lehman very much prided itself in a strong risk management culture.
I was on the trading floor in 2007, Lehman Brothers, and from the top down, the basic mantra was take more risk, take more risk, take more risk.
That's Lawrence McDonald, who worked at Lehman and also wrote a book about his time there. He said Fold's testimony shows a man who's still in denial. At the hearing, regulators emphasized that Lehman was beyond saving. Thomas Baxter is with the New York Federal Reserve.
One definition of insolvent is failure to pay your debts as they come due. And that was the situation that Lehman was experiencing.
The commission's hearings continue today with testimony from Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke. Brett Neely, NPR News, Washington.
In Britain, rural communities are losing vital services because of cuts in public spending. Pubs are closing down, and so are post offices and local stores. Many places have been left without a center for community life. But Vicky Barker reports that some British villagers are taking matters into their own hands.
English villages don't look or sound much more timeless than Appleton. It's a cozy cluster of golden and gray stone houses lying about 7 miles from Oxford, near the River Thames. Every week, teams of bell ringers converge on the ancient church here, drawn to its unusual 10 bells. Inside, local ladies arrange armfuls of white flowers for a wedding.
We've got lilies, we've got roses, alstroemeria, lisianthus. We've got the Michaelmas daisies, the white ones, and lots of foliage. Lovely roses here.
If St. Lawrence's Church is the heart of this village, just across the street is Appleton's Life's Blood, its community store. Parishioner Anna Ford.
It makes an enormous difference, particularly for the older folk of the village and the young mums collecting children from the village school.
£2.11, please.
So big a difference that when villagers heard Appleton's convenience store, its only store, was closing down, they took it over themselves.
My name's Lorraine Page. I'm here doing my volunteer stint from 11 till 1 behind the counter, and that's my bit that I do each week. Hello.
About 100 locals take turns pricing items, checking the inventory, manning the cash register.
£1.99, please.
Lovely. Put the penny in the jar.
Thanks very much indeed. Put it into the little box. There we are.
On the store's bulging shelves, you can find hair ties, razor blades, bread, sugar. In its humming refrigerator and freezer compartments, local cheeses, meats, and produce.
Need something special delivery to London? Please.
In one corner, a glassed-in booth serves as the village post office, and Gossip Central says postmistress Juliet Carter.
If there is ever a queue, they're always so busy talking to each other that nobody notices, you know. But we don't get many queues here.
Like village stores, post offices are another endangered species on the English rural landscape. Carter's kept her job, but has had her hours cut to 2 mornings a week. But that's better than nothing. With the nearest bank miles away and local bus services patchy, Carter says her older customers rely on her to cash their pension checks.
I would notice immediately if one of my regulars didn't turn up. So if there was a problem, someone's had a fall or something, we'd know if they didn't come on their regular slot.
Nick and Sarah have swapped.
Oh, they've swapped
with Clive.
Oh, okay.
In the store's tiny office, Carol Bateman goes over the week's schedule with volunteer Margaret Redding. A retired IT manager at Oxford University, Bateman serves on the shop's board.
The cynics of the village thought that it would only last 6 months, and now we're 9 or 10 years on, and we're doing very well, so much so that we're actually able to give money to local charities as well.
Fired by the success of the store, Appleton has now drawn up a 10-year plan to further strengthen community life, including working to keep the town's medical practice open, improving local broadband service, and building a playground. And it's become a model for other towns in the area, hoping to make their communities closer. Margaret Redding says she's heard that 214 self-run community stores have opened up in the UK in the past decade or so.
And out of that 214, only 5 have failed. Well, that's a pretty good rate, I would say, for businesses.
The store gets small grants from rural charities when it needs to replace equipment, and it's exempt from commercial property tax. But no government money's involved, just the sweat equity of locals who don't want to see their community die. For NPR News, I'm Vicki Barker in Appleton, England.